Welcome to Trial Tested, a podcast by the American College of Trial Lawyers, an enlightening discussion about life and law created to elevate and inspire trial attorneys. I am Amy Gunn, and I will be your host for today's episode. Hello, everyone. Today, I have the privilege to bring you a conversation with Sharon McMahon. Sharon McMahon is a former high school government and law teacher who has earned a reputation as America's government teacher, which began amidst the historic 2020 election proceedings for her viral posts on Instagram to educate the general public on political misinformation. Through a simple mission to share nonpartisan information about democracy, Sharon has amassed over a million followers online, affectionately called Governerds, who look to her for truth and logic. Sharon has provided education on many hot-button topics from impeachment trials to QAnon conspiracies to the U.S. Constitution and civil rights. She's been featured by CNN, The Washington Post, Yahoo News, The Daily Show, and was the subject of a substantial article in The Atlantic. Sharon has also received numerous awards for her work, including the 2022 Communicator of the Year Award from PR Week, the 2022 Roger S. Horchow Award for Outstanding Public Service by a Private Citizen. She's also received the Webby Award for Best Writing for her excellent podcast entitled Sharon Says So, where she covers interesting topics through docuseries episodes and expert interviews. She shares her talent to raise funds for important causes such as paying down massive medical debt that brings financial strain upon so many of our families. Welcome, Sharon. It's great to speak with you today. And I am honored to be here with you today to learn more about your story and to be educated about how to be a better citizen, a better neighbor, a better lawyer. So let's start with, how on earth did you go from being a high school government and law teacher to now being a nationally known authority on the truth?
Well, thanks for inviting me. I appreciate the invitation. It's great to talk to you. I appreciate your mission. You know, we need more people in the boat rowing for the same goal, right? Which is having better educated citizenry, because that benefits all of us. So it can't just be my job. It can't just be your job. We all have a part to play. So I really appreciate your efforts. You know, my story is an unlikely one in many ways. I never set out to do what I'm doing now. I was a classroom educator for a long time. My background is in the academic study of constitutional law, not the practice of law. Many times people have asked me, like, why don't you just become an attorney? Well, you know the reasons why I wouldn't do that. I don't need to tell you. There's a lot of wonderful things about being an attorney, and they play an incredibly important role. But the practice of law is not particularly interesting to me, but educating about constitutional law is. I'm not your girl if you want to talk about contract law or employment law or whatever. Like, that's not, I can't help you. I'm going to refer you to a qualified professional.
Understood.
But I love talking about the Supreme Court. I love talking about, you know, topics like that. So this all really started in the run-up to the 2020 election, which, no matter who you voted for, who you wanted to see win, everyone agrees was crazy. Nobody wishes for a repeat of the 2020 election. Again, doesn't matter if you were happy with the results or not. You probably think, like, phew, I don't want to do that again. And I was seeing a tremendous amount of misinformation on social media, which shockingly still exists. We have not stamped that out in the last few years. But there was one moment in particular that I can put my finger on where I saw a man replying to a thread on Facebook, on one of my friend's threads. And he was talking about how when people attend or graduate from the Electoral College, and I was like, hold up. this is not an opinion. You can have all kinds of opinions, but this is just a lie.
Right.
Right? Like, this is factually incorrect. So I decided in that moment, you know, like, what I really wanted to do was say, listen here, Chad, you don't know what's what. I wanted to, you know, get into an argument with him, but I resisted that urge, which attorneys have to do all the time, resist the urge to just argue back and forth with somebody who you know is just straight up wrong or lying, misinformed. Right. I resisted the urge and instead made a little nonpartisan, fact-based explainer video about how the Electoral College worked. Very, very approachable. Like I tried to explain it like I would explain it to a classroom of 16-year-olds in a non-patronizing way. I made a point of not using the candidates' real names. I invented, you know, just fake names for candidates, and I used little props. And my goal in that video was to have something that people could refer back to, that other people who knew Chad could be like, watch this video. And I said at the top, this is a nonpartisan, fact-based explainer video. I'm not going to tell you who to vote for or who should win the Electoral College. I'm just going to explain how it works. So that is really the genesis of what I am doing now, is the videos that I started making took off. I started getting media requests to explain some of these more challenging concepts related to American government and American constitutional law. What would happen if X, you know, like I can imagine that you really are familiar with how many questions people had at the end of 2020, where people were like, what would happen if Y occurred? What would happen if A, B, and C occurred? All of these legal unknowns, what would happen? So that was really how I got started doing what I'm doing. And I just kept doing it. That is really the difference between a lot of successful people and people who maybe have a great idea but never take it anywhere, is that they keep doing it. They keep showing up. They keep putting one foot in front of the other, even when they don't feel like it.
I really love that story, because I think persistence in doing that every day, but also in being accurate and really embracing this notion that you're going to stay nonpartisan and go down roads that kind of put you in the fire, right? I mean, so you've got your Instagram. I know you've got a wonderful podcast. With respect to your Instagram account, Sharon Says So, I know you've got over a million followers now? And I guess there's pushback from time to time. Like, how do you handle that?
Of course there is pushback. The Chads who are like, when you graduate from the Electoral College, their perspective is not going to be like, wow, Sharon, thanks for educating me. I now get it. And I am totally on board with what you have to say. Of course, people don't like being told that they're wrong. It makes people feel defensive. So especially when it comes to politics today, when it comes to, you know, a candidate that you might be wedded to or an ideology that you might find very favorable, especially when it comes to that, those topics have become not just topics of preference, not just, well, I think that we should have, you know, more free school lunches, or I think the top marginal tax rate should be X. We know it's no longer a preference. It's become, for many people, an identity. And when you attack an identity, that feels extremely offensive to people. Even if you are doing it in a gentle way, even if you are, you know, taking caution to tread lightly, when something is an identity level belief for somebody, which for many people, a great example of this is their religious faith, if you have one. If you identify as a, you know, a Christian of a certain perspective, or you were, you know, you're Jewish or you're Muslim or whatever it is, often your religious faith is an identity level, you know, belief system. It underpins everything you believe about the world. And if I were to attack your religious faith, if I were to say, gosh, it's so stupid that you think that, what kind of an idiot believes A, B, and C? You are not, at the end of that conversation, going to say, I have really seen the light about my religious faith. Thank you for turning me away from something that I hold dear. That's not going to be your perspective. And so I think it's important for us to remember that for many Americans, political ideology, political party identification has become as formational to their identity as a religious faith.
Is that different and a modern thing, or has it always been the case?
There are times in history where you can point to, I'm thinking specifically about like the Civil War related to enslavement and segregation, where those types of political beliefs were foundational to people's identity. I'm a son of the South. Those were foundational to identity. But for the most part throughout history, people in American history, people have been able to have beliefs about politics of, you know, I prefer Harry Truman. I like Richard Nixon more. They were able to have preferences about politics without adopting it as an identity. You can go back to watching some of the presidential debates between, say, John McCain and Barack Obama. Or, you know, there's other examples that I can, many examples I can give you from history, where even during the presidential debates, the candidates are cordial to one another. They chuckle with one another. In the debate between John Kerry and George W. Bush, John Kerry says, you know, Laura, she's a fantastic first lady. I just really appreciate them. You know, I appreciate how, you know, he has done X, Y, and Z things. He's able to articulate what he likes about George W. Bush, even though he has different ideas about how the country should be run. And then the moderator asks George W. Bush a question about John Kerry. Do you think he has the character to do X, Y, and Z? And George W. Bush says, I'm not going to go there. That's not my business. What I can tell you is, you know, here's what I think about, you know, the war in Iraq, and here's how John Kerry views that differently. And so that has changed in America. And I think most people know it. I think most people realize that we are no longer in a position of being able to say, I don't prefer to vote Democrat, but here's something that I think that the Democratic candidate is doing well. Or I don't really align with Republicans, but you know what? I sure appreciate how they show up to the 4th of July parades and they really exhibit their patriotism. We now view our political beliefs as so formational to our identity that anybody who does not share this identity is in the outgroup, they are evil, and they must be attacked or eliminated. For millions of Americans, that's where we are.
Do you think we can get back to a time where your political identification or belief isn't that identity level belief that you've mentioned? Can we do it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we absolutely can, because for a four-year time period in the mid-19th century, 600 to 700,000 people were willing to die for their political beliefs. And then we were able to move away from that and into the scenario I'm describing with John McCain defending Barack Obama at a town hall meeting, where a woman stands up and says, well, I just don't believe that he's an American. I just don't believe that he's really a Christian. This was during the whole, he's not really an American, the birth certificate story. And John McCain walks over to the woman, takes the microphone out of her hand and says, no, ma'am, no, ma'am, no, ma'am. And he interrupts her and says, this is a good American. This is a good man. And we just have different ideas about how to achieve similar goals.
To answer your question, no, I can't imagine that happening today with our current candidates. But as you say, the McCain-Obama debate wasn't that long ago. And that town hall with Senator McCain wasn't that long ago. And I do remember that. And I was struck by it. I was profoundly admirational of Senator McCain for that stand that he took, because we were going the other way and he kind of pulled it back on track. I feel like we're completely off track right now with our current discourse, both at the candidate level and at the voter level. And it sounds like, though, that history has shown us that we can get it back on track. And I think it starts with some of the things that you're doing, which is really getting information out there and, more importantly, teaching us, teaching your listeners and anyone who is interested in how to do it, how to have a civilized debate, how to have a conversation with someone with whom you disagree without screaming and yelling and it devolving into cursing, which is unfortunately what it ends up doing sometimes in my mind. I mean, I try not to have those conversations.
Yes. It is possible to get it back on track because, as you mentioned, we've done it before. We've done it before and we can do it again. There has really never been a time in American history where the American people have set their mind to something and not been able to achieve it.
So we have to want to achieve it.
Yep. I can't make us achieve it. As much as I want it, other people have to want it too. And it is not going to be a, you know, like, well, Sharon said so, so I'm just going to do it. The change will come when people decide that they want to change. And my hope is, you know, I liken it a little bit to being like the side of the swimming pool. Right now, a lot of people are out in the middle of the swimming pool being like, I'm not coming in. You can't make me. I'm going to be out here swimming as long as I want, you know, but eventually they're going to get tired. They are not going to be able to tread water all alone in the middle of the swimming pool anymore. And they are going to need a safe place to return to. And if they try to swim back to the side of the pool and the person standing there is like, what an idiot you are for thinking you could tread water all day. Give me a break. That is going to be a very different experience than somebody who is waiting saying, hey, did you want something to drink? Like, let's climb on out of here and let's get a snack. That is a much safer place emotionally for somebody to change their mind. And people do not change their mind outside of a few very specific circumstances. They need to have the emotional safety to change their mind, and they need to want to change their mind. And they do not tend to listen until they feel listened to. And I would imagine you know all about this in the trial world.
It reminds me, the ACTL had a conference a few years ago. One of our speakers was Kate Murphy, who is a journalist and author, who wrote a book called You're Not Listening, What You're Missing and Why It Matters. And the theme of her book, which I've read and I've spoken with her, is that really what you're saying is to be listened to, you need to be a good listener. And that seems just lost on so many people. I'm going to learn so much more about you and about the best way to respond to you if I just listened a little bit. So how do we get people to listen to us?
We get people to listen to us by first listening to them. I have a neighbor. I live in a rural area. And I have a neighbor who has, for the last couple of years, had a political sign in his yard that has the F word on it. And then it has some pictures and it has some very derogatory terms about the people who are depicted on his sign. And this sign has been very offensive to me for a while because my children go by this house with this flag many times a day. School buses of children are driving past this man's house with the F word and the pictures and the slurs. And I'm like, but do we need to do it this way? You know, like that's my gut reaction. Do we need to have the F word on a huge flag outside your house that my kids have to see 20 times a day? And what I am struck by is when I set aside my own frustration about this man and the way that he's expressing his opinions, when I set it aside and I really think about it, I realize that what is underneath his choice of expression is a man who does not feel listened to. He does not think anyone is listening. And perhaps his attempts to express his opinion in more mild ways were met with stonewalling, or they were never considered. And so he has now risen to the point of frustration. The only way that he can feel listened to is by creating speech that is so egregious that school buses of children must be subjected to it. That is a man who lacks social capital. I don't know him very well personally, but I can almost promise you he is lacking in close personal friendships. He is perhaps doesn't have any close family relationships, or if they are, they're dysfunctional. Now, this is a psychological profile that many people who study this type of thing would tell you people like this are more prone to having. And he profoundly feels unlistened to. And so my husband and I over the last couple of years have undertaken an effort to be nice to this man. And instead of writing letters and be like, take down your stinking sign, I'm going to report you, or I'm going to steal your sign, or your sign, what kind of idiot has this sign? And I will tell you that after a couple of years of concerted effort, he has taken down the sign and now just has a normal political sign that has the name of a candidate 2024, which is perfectly acceptable. I do not care that you have candidate name 2024. Great. That's well within the realm of normal political discourse in the United States. And can I claim sole credit of like, yeah, I pat on the back. I got him to take this stupid sign down. Of course I can't. But I can promise you that if I sent him mean letters, or I left a note on his door, or if I reported him, or if I called the cops, or if I called the news, he would get more and bigger signs. He wouldn't just have one, he'd have five, because what he wants is to feel listened to. So at the core of this problem that we are facing is people who feel profoundly uncared about. They feel as though they have something important to say and nobody's listening to it. And if we want people to listen to us, we first have to listen to them, even if what we're listening to is stupid, it's offensive, it feels like, but why do I need to listen to lies? I'm not advocating that every single person needs to expend a tremendous amount of their time and energy engaged in these kinds of conversations with every single person they come across. But this man is my literal neighbor. He's my literal neighbor. I can't develop relationships with everybody that has an offensive sign in their yard, but I can with my one neighbor, and I can with my one family member. And it's up to each of us to decide, which people are important for us to engage with. But if we want to move the needle, it is going to require collective effort on all of our parts to first listen before we demand to be listened to.
What you're describing, the way people dig in and the reasons why, there seems like there's so much psychology in in your teaching. What's your education in psychology? Just come naturally? You're a mom? Is that what happens?
Well, I mean, as a teacher, I am licensed to teach psychology. I'm not a psychologist. But really, a lot of my learning on this topic comes from experts in this topic. People who actually study this, foundational identity level moral beliefs. So, I've interviewed many of them. I've read many books. I've had many private conversations. I've read lots of studies. So I have taken the work of experts whose life work is understanding people like this and incorporate that into what I talk about. It's not meant to replace therapy or anything of that nature. It's just to help us understand our neighbors a little bit more, because right now, it would be easy for me to just think, well, my neighbor is a psycho, right? Like, that is what a lot of people would just say. Yeah, he's a psycho. And we'd drive past his house every day and my kids would be like, why does he have that sign in his ear? Because he's a psycho, because he's evil, because he's stupid. That's the knee-jerk reaction. That's our explanation for things. And most of the time, that's not the explanation. Most of the time, it's not psychopathy. Most of the time, they believe they have very legitimate reasons for acting the way they do. And they make complete sense in their minds. It's not irrational to them.
One of your offerings from your website includes workshops on various issues, abortion, gun rights, etc. I'm interested to know, how can I have a conversation with the colleague of mine when we are completely opposite on the gun issue? Teach me how I can do that.
It starts really by not going into the conversation with a goal of changing that person's mind. As soon as that's your goal, you know, trial attorneys are very uniquely equipped in this regard, right? They are very uniquely equipped to persuade. Successful trial attorneys are great debaters. They understand the psychology of juries and of defendants and of plaintiffs. This is an area in which, you know, it's just the ability to argue from a position of logic and being, you know, law school teaches you this, to consider the logical conclusion of any specific argument you're trying to make. So if you make this man take down his F the candidate's flag, what's the logical conclusion of that? What, the government's going to start policing your political speech? Like, these are the types of things that people who attend law school consider, the logical conclusion of any argument. There is this concept that the more adept somebody is, the more of an expert they are in a topic, the less well-equipped they are to teach beginners. And my friend Adam Grant highlights this exact study in his new book, Hidden Potential, that, you know, freshman level university classes fare better when they are taught not by the highest level expert, but by somebody that's more of a like mid-level expert in this topic. And one of the reasons for that is the knowledge gap. The extraordinary expert in a topic does not realize how little the person down here knows. And they tend to operate from this position of like, yeah, you just turn the screw 18 times to the left, give it a little pull, and it's going to work. And the person, the beginner, is like, what screw are you talking about? I'm not even aware of the existence of screws. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So when we are having these kinds of conversations with people, we first have to, specifically when it comes to guns, stop operating from the position of, I'm going to convince you that my way is the correct way. And instead, I'm going to try to understand what I can learn from you. When we operate from a posture of what can I learn versus how can I win?
Yes.
And boy, this is real tough for your audience. How can I win? That's how you get the cash, right? Like, how can I win? That's your status in this community. And I get that. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't have that viewpoint when you're trying to win a case for a client. But when it comes to interpersonal relationships, what shifting this conversation from how can I win to what can I learn is how you can have these kinds of conversations. Saying things like, I would love to know more about when you got your first gun. I would love to hear more about that story. Did your dad take you hunting? Did you do target practice? Were you in Boy Scouts? Where you did like skeet shooting? Where, you know, how did you first become interested in this topic? Or conversely, I would love to know more about, you know, an event in your life that helped you realize I strongly oppose everybody just being able to have all the guns they want. Asking them to tell you about how they came to believe something feels a lot less confrontational than asking them, why do you think that?
Right. That's stupid. Why would you ever think that?
Right. Why has become a very confrontational question. So instead of why, I like how.
Right.
How did you come to believe that? What were the formational experiences that led you to arriving at this conclusion?
And I think that goes back to listening and understanding. I don't know what went on in any particular person's life to bring them to their beliefs. And this is kind of what you spoke about a minute ago. And without me knowing where that belief comes from, how deeply it's held, how long it's been there, I'm not going to be able to judge whether I can actually persuade that person to a different point of view, if that's my goal. So it starts again with being a good listener and asking open-ended, non-confrontational questions. I think what we lose, though, is where does that conversation even occur? Where does it start? And I know that I, oddly enough, as a trial attorney, I think a lot of people think we love to argue and we love to get in the fray. I can't stand it in my actual life. In my real life, I don't want any conflict. I don't want to debate anybody about anything because part of it is it's not that important to me. Maybe it should be, but it's not important enough for me to convince you of something as it is just to get done what I need to get done that day. But without engaging, we're never going to get back on the track. After I've been reviewing all of your information and my research for this interview, it just made me think, I'm not really being the best citizen and neighbor I can be if I'm not even trying to try to get the train back on the track. And that's what I love about your advocacy is you really are trying to provide an outlet, a kickstart, if you will, to our nation sort of engaging and not just guns blazing, so to speak, but just really engaging in conversation, whether it's through your workshops or listening to your podcast. I really do admire that. And I want to ask, where do you get your facts? Where do you start?
That's a great question. And it's a question a lot of people ask too. Like, well, why would I trust your facts? You know, like in an age of facts and alternative facts, how do we know what we're talking about here? And I think transparency is super important. I tell people all the time, don't trust what other people tell you. When it comes to these topics, like, yeah, if you have a heart surgeon, there's a level of trust there. You can't do your own heart surgery, of course. But when we're talking about matters of opinion or political topics, you shouldn't just trust what I say. That I would be disingenuous if I said, just trust me, bro. The trust me bros are the worst people. I hate the trust me bros, right? And the trust me bros often say the most outlandish things. So I really despise the standard of trust me because I'm an expert. The best communicators on any topic, science, health, politics, government, are transparent in how they came to their conclusions. And one of the things that I think is important is to tell people where information came from. So one of the things that I do is I make a point of reading news sources from across the spectrum every day. When we're talking about a current event, I will read probably 10 to 15 news sources, more depending on the topic, that range from, you know, MSNBC all the way over to, say, like a Newsmax, you know, and in the entire spectrum here. Most people read the headlines of one news source a day. Right. And it's the one that supports their preferred narrative. If you are left-leaning, you're probably reading MSNBC or CNN. If you are more right-leaning, you're probably reading Fox or Newsmax. Right. Most people just like, that's my favorite place. They say things I like to hear. And I'm just going to skim and see, oh, yeah, Biden's the worst. That's right. I agree. Or, gosh, Trump's terrible. I agree. Wow. More new evidence about how terrible he is. Those are narratives that feel comfortable to our brains, regardless of which perspective you hold. Our brains like to have information that we already believe reaffirmed to us. That feels extremely comfortable in our brains. We love to look for information that confirms what we already think because it feels good in our brains. And we subconsciously dislike being confronted with information that contradicts what we already believe. That feels bad to us. And that's why people are mad when you try to tell them, like, the facts say. So that's, you know, reading broadly from a spectrum is important. But also telling people here, when we're talking about the economy, for example, where does economic data come from? A lot of people don't know. They have no idea about the Department of Labor statistics. They don't know what that is. So being able to show people, here's where you can go to look for information about X, Y, and Z feels empowering, gives them the opportunity to gather their own information instead of just being told, Trust me.
I read that you were the keynote speaker last October at a Utah Valley University event. It was a sold out crowd. And in that presentation, you said, government is not responsible for making us just, peaceful, good, and free. Rather, that is our job. I want to understand that a little bit better.
Well, if you think about the preamble to the Constitution, you know, we the people, in order to form a more perfect union, et cetera, establish justice. I won't repeat the entire preamble. If you distill it down to its essence, that is America's statement of purpose, is that the Constitution exists to make us, to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility. Put it more simply, it is designed to help us become just, peaceful, good, and free. Those are the concepts in the preamble to the Constitution. And the preamble is like an introduction, of course. It's the introduction to the Constitution. Why are we writing this? So that America can become just, peaceful, good, and free. And the government exists because of with the consent of the governed. The government is meant to be from us. I think so often we sit back and wait for somebody to come save us, whether we believe that that's the government's job, or whether we believe that it's a religious figure's job, or a political figure's job, or some mythical person in the future who will come to fix it all. The answer to all of that is no. That's not going to fix it. If the government could fix it, it would have done it by now. It is all of our jobs to uphold the American ideals of being just, being peaceful, being good, and being free. And if we're no longer in a position of just waiting it out. We're the people we've been waiting for. It's up to us to uphold these ideals, not some other entity. They're not going to come and do it for us.
Well, and I think it's not the government's job to do those things for every individual citizen. Your idea of freedom is different than my idea of freedom. What does that mean? And one of my favorite quotes is that your freedom ends where mine begins. And I looked this up because I say it all the time and I fail to cite my sources. It's attributable to Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., a Supreme Court justice. And I mean, I think that sort of points up to me a lot of what is going on, where people just don't recognize that. Somehow, for example, your neighbor's freedom to fly whatever flag he wants to fly doesn't end at his front yard. It is available to the whole world to see. And your thought is, well, you know, that kind of impinges on my freedom not to be, not to have my children read something that I don't think is appropriate in normal civil circles. So how do we get that across? Because I say this all the time. Look, you have an opinion. That's great. You can act on that opinion up to the point where it hits me in the face. And then we're going to have a problem.
Mm-hmm. I always talk about it, with a couple of different concepts. This is one that, man, I get a lot of pushback from. And the fact that I get a lot of pushback on it means that I'm going to keep saying it.
I gotcha.
Because it's something that people are poorly understanding, that no rights are absolute. There's no concept in American legal jurisprudence and constitutional case law in which rights are absolute. And when we talk about it from the perspective of like, you absolutely have the right to free speech. Does that give you the right to break into my house in the middle of the night to tell me that I'm ugly? Of course, we would all be like, no, that's not freedom of speech, right? Like your property rights, your right to privacy, et cetera. There's a line that can't be crossed when it comes to your freedom of speech. Does your freedom of religion give you the right to kidnap my child and be like, well, God told me to? No. Of course not. We can all agree that there, when you give these specific examples, then people can, I feel like, begin to understand that no rights are absolute. And so consequently, this is a very tricky concept in constitutional law that we will probably never, ever, ever be done wrestling with, is where's the balance? What is the balancing test for this right versus that right? Where is the balance between your right to freedom of speech and my right to not have my children read the F word 12 times a day on your sign? Where is the balance? And that is a conversation that lots of people are not having. Where's the balance between these things? It's either we have freedom and I'm free to do whatever I want. That's how they equate freedom. I can do whatever I want. Or we have fascism. Those are the only two options that many people think exists, right?
Right.
And a well-ordered society requires some rules. And no, you know, these are just the nuances of these conversations are lost in the clickbaity headlines of modern political discourse.
Yeah.
Bringing it to a modern topic with your constitutional law expertise and your expertise in the Supreme Court. One of the issues that I believe our court will see shortly is whether one of our presidential candidates or both of our presidential candidates will remain on the ballot. And my understanding is that it's a 14th Amendment argument. The 14th Amendment, I believe it was Article 3, talks about if you engage in insurrection, you shouldn't hold or can't hold public office. I know it's from 1868, and it's an oldie but a goodie. Any predictions on how that's going to turn out?
I think the court is going to dance the fastest tap dance they have ever danced in an effort to try to avoid answering that question. I know for sure that John Roberts does not want to answer the question, did Donald Trump commit insurrection? He's going to do whatever it takes to avoid answering that question. And some people have hypothesized, you know, like Judge Michael Luttig, who is a very prominent former conservative federal judge, thinks that they're going to try to not answer the question, but they're not going to be able to. They're going to be forced to answer the question. But I can promise you it's a question that Roberts really, 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 really does not want to answer. His goal is always to tailor his decisions in the most narrow way possible. And he even said this in the court's recent Dobbs decision. Roberts really did not want to take that case up. He really did not want to answer the question on whether the Constitution permits abortion. He just didn't, even though Roberts is personally Catholic, he's personally pro-life, he has an allegiance to the Constitution and not his personal beliefs. And so he just knew that the larger societal ramifications of that question would be more than he wanted the court to get into at that moment. But nevertheless, he's outvoted. He doesn't have more votes than anybody else. So it's a very tricky topic, whether or not they will actually directly answer the question of whether a candidate committed insurrection. I don't know. The other question that they are going to be forced to answer is whether states are permitted to interpret this question for themselves, or whether the federal government must make determinations of insurrection. And if it's the federal government, then which entity is it? Because there is not like a federal office of, who's on the ballot, election police. We don't have that. Whose job is it? Is it Congress? Is it, we would assume it's not the executive branch? Who is making this determination? And if it's Congress, then by what process? What is the process for declaring someone an insurrectionist in Congress? That's never happened before. Even when it was added to the Constitution, a lot of people have mentioned that somebody has not been convicted, that Trump has not been convicted of insurrection. The Constitution doesn't require a conviction, or at least it doesn't say that it requires a conviction, because most of the Southern secessionists were never prosecuted for insurrection. They were never prosecuted for trying to secede. It was just this sort of carte blanche of, we're not taking any of y'all, the Confederate leaders. None of you Confederate leaders, 0% of you. We're not getting in here. And so they intentionally didn't include a clause requiring conviction, because at the time, the thinking was, if you were a Confederate leader, just blanket no, you can't do it. But that blanket no doesn't really apply to 2024. We don't have states trying to secede and people trying to create a different government in like the southern states of America. We don't have that. So this blanket no of no Confederate leaders, how does that apply to 2024? That is far more likely a question that the court is going to have to answer.
Well, we will look forward to hearing what the answer to that is.
Now, will we?
I don't know. I don't know. I just hold my breath every time I hear that an opinion is coming out, because I just don't know what it's going to say.
I know. Yes, I understand. Some people, I think most people, just like I was saying earlier, most people don't want another repeat of 2020.
No.
Again, regardless of who you voted for, we're like, let's not do that again. And so I think a lot of people feel the same level of reticence to hear what the court is going to say of like, do we want to know? I don't know if we do, because no matter what the answer is, the repercussions, I'm not going to like the repercussions.
Yes.
Not going to like it.
No. Mm-hmm. And I'm a student of politics, and I remember in my life when we got to an election year, I was excited. It was going to be exciting and fun and lots of interesting debates to watch. And this year, the calendar turned and my heart sank. Like, this is going to be such a contentious year. I'm going to have a hard time even listening to, quote, the news, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're not alone. You are not alone. Huge percentage of the people in my community feel a tremendous amount of anxiety. Mm-hmm. About 2024. And like, I don't even want to think about October.
Right.
I like the month of October, like so many people tell me, I don't even want to think about it. It fills me with dread.
What is your advice for us, teacher, on how to make it through 2024?
Well, listen, I'm not going to make any friends at any news networks by saying this, but the first thing is to stop watching the news. And to consume your news by reading. Reading tends to be far less inflammatory than a talking head on TV. It's much easier to skim. It's much easier to get the gist. But, you know, sitting through, our next guest is Bob, who's going to tell you all the reasons why candidate ABC is the worst human that has ever walked the earth. Right. And in order to get to the hard news, you have to sit through Bob and then 14 commercial breaks. Stop watching the news and start reading the news. And then secondly, I also recommend getting your news from a wire service like AP News or Reuters, who sell their stories to all of these other news organizations. And so consequently, their editorial viewpoint is about as neutral as exists in the political landscape. It's not about trying to prop up one candidate or disparage another. It's really like, here are the facts, because all of the other news agencies, Newsmax to MSNBC, are using the reporting of organizations like AP News and Reuters to inform some of their stories. So if people on both sides of the aisle rely on the facts provided by the wire services, then you can feel reasonably assured that these facts can be verified. So that's just an easy tip. Just read your news once a day.
I do think one of the reasons for your success is grounded in what you've just said, which is facts are important. Facts are attainable. Someone speaking opinion couched as fact you should be able to figure that out or just listen for a little bit. Go to an actual source of facts. And I think what you've done and is attributable to your success is you've built trust. You've built trust in your listeners. I think we can all learn from that. And that's what trial attorneys try to do with juries. We try to present facts, not just opinion, but facts based in evidence that we're going to present to you and people on the stand and documents that we show you. And that builds trust. And it's so important to persuade, to be able to persuade and convince someone that they trust you beforehand. What other advice do you have for trial attorneys to earn trust?
That's a great question. And I do think transparency earns trust. And I think it's important to say, now, we don't know where Bob went when he left Sandra's house. But here is what we do know. You know, like being able to say what I do know or what I don't know, but here is for sure what I do know. Because juries and the people at large don't believe that you know everything. And if you pretend that you know everything, that is a cause for distrust. That is very used car salesman-y. That comes across exactly as a red flag. That person's cocky. That person can never admit when they're wrong. We actually have more affection and affinity for people who can admit what they do know and what they do not know. So I think that's one way that you can build trust with juries is saying, we don't know what happened when she left her house. We don't know where her cell phone is, but I can tell you what we do know. And here's what I can demonstrate to you through evidence is, you know, the following five facts. I think another thing that's important when it comes to building trust with people is assuming their intelligence, speaking to them as though they are intelligent, but always being mindful of not overwhelming them with things that are ultimately irrelevant. A confused mind says no. A confused mind says no. And so when I'm talking to a classroom or I'm speaking to a group or I'm talking on Instagram, I'm only going to include things that are actually important for you to remember. I'm not going to be like, and what was his grandmother's middle name when she was born on August 2nd, 1843? Is that actually important for you to know? Probably not. And if it is important, then we're going to highlight it, right? But we're not going to confuse people with a deluge of extraneous information. But we have to balance that with treating them as though they're intelligent. It's too easy to get into this very elementary mindset that it is a turnoff for people. People do not want to feel patronized. They want to feel like you think they are smart. And I will often say to people, it's no wonder this is easy to misunderstand, because this is extremely complicated. People get PhDs in this topic and still don't fully understand it. So you are not alone if this is confusing to you. Boy, people like to feel like they're not alone. Nobody wants to be the dumb kid in the back of the class. So that's another thing that I try to hit home to people. You're not alone if this is confusing to you. You're not alone if you feel anxious about this. People tell me that every day. People tell me that all the time. And that's the truth. But I think helping people feel not alone and then say, you're not alone if this is confusing, which is why I have this chart to break it down, which is why we have Kathy here who's going to help us understand this. There's just this balance. Ultimately, it's a balance between respecting people's intelligence while not overwhelming them with irrelevant things that makes their mind confused, and then they ultimately say no.
I'll give you credit, but I am going to steal. I don't know if that's stealing if I give you credit. I'm going to use a confused mind says no. So much in what we try to do is try to be clear. I do plaintiff's work, and so my job is I've got the burden of proof. I have to convince to a certain standard. And I have learned in my time doing this that if there's too much information and it's too complicated, I'm not going to win. And I've never heard it reduced to such a truth, which is a confused mind says no. So thank you for that.
And I respect how challenging it is with highly technical cases to not overburden the jury. What a fine line you have to continually try to walk of like, I need to include this. We have to talk about it, but how do we talk about it without overwhelming them and without half the people falling asleep?
Right.
Now, tell us about your upcoming book. Can you tell us about it? Is it still undercover?
It is a little bit undercover, but it's coming out in September of 2024. It's called The Small and the Mighty, and it is stories of unsung Americans who have changed the course of history. People that you probably have never heard of, but who played a really integral role in something important in the United States. And my hope is that these stories will help point us to ways that we can all be more just, more peaceful, more good, more free, that it will be a counterpoint to the noise and the doom of the upcoming 2024 election cycle, that they will become people that we will develop our own affinities for, and that we can look to when times become challenging, as they inevitably will. So that's an exciting, we're working on the final edits of the manuscript literally today. I'm excited for September.
Has anyone asked you whether you are interested in getting involved yourself in politics as a candidate?
Of course. People jokingly tell me to run for president all the time, which...
Just start at the top.
That's, of course, silly. Being president sounds like an absolutely terrible job. Doesn't it? Doesn't it sound absolutely terrible?
It sounds really heartbreaking. It does.
It sounds absolutely terrible. There is at least one 24-hour news network dedicated to hating you.
Right. At least one.
At least one. Imagine what that does to one's psyche. I just can't imagine a worse job. I love living in my little house in the woods, where you can't even see my house from the street, and I just walk around in my robe, wear a visor, and grow some hydrangeas. You know, I value my privacy so much. I cannot imagine a worse job. Living in a rural area, though, it actually would be very easy to get involved in politics because there's just not that many people that are interested in doing it. But some people are great candidates, and some people are great educators, and I really view my calling as that of educator and not of professional politician.
Well, on behalf of the American College, I do appreciate your role as an educator. I'm glad that you're continuing to do that and that you will continue to do that. What is next for you?
A book tour. Be able to come see me on tour if you want to. You know, we're always releasing new podcast episodes, a new docuseries about events from history. And, you know, it'll be very interesting to see what happens with the 2024 election. So I'll be around. You'll be able to find me.
Well, I'm very glad that you'll be around to help us digest and better understand what's happening around us, particularly in this election year. So, Sharon, thank you so much for your time today. I really do appreciate it and wish you the very best of luck.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Trial Tested is a podcast by the American College of Trial Lawyers. Help us share these inspiring episodes about life and law by liking, subscribing, and reviewing our podcast. Thank you for listening.